I've got this picture of you, Tom, sitting there staring at this sheet of list of drivers and trying to organise who's going to be in the press conference.
My brain was mush.
I mean, you work so hard.
And I don't work hard, but my brain...
Do you get any therapy or anything, you know, to help
this
you?
This is my therapy. You are my therapy. Well, I tell you what, it is hard when you're having to look at this Excel spreadsheet, because the teams want to know who's in the press conference up to and including Hungary now. And I'm just staring, looking at all these lines of drivers' names. And actually, we've got Hamilton and Alonso in the press conference in Monaco, which should be quite tasty. Anyway.
So I suppose we ought to start the show then, Tom. You take it away. Come on. You know what to do.
Well, so do you.
Well, we're going to have a competition, if you like, then. We'll see who does the best intro. Welcome to this week's episode of F1 Nation, where we think about the upcoming race, which is the Monaco Grand Prix.
Right. Well, if I'm starting the show this week, I want a drum roll. Have we got a drum roll on this machine? I think we've got a drum roll. Right, here we go. Welcome, everyone, to F1 Nation with me, Tom Clarkson, and that man there, Damon Hill.
I think you win. Nice one.
So, Damon, it's been a lay week from Formula One, a week off. What have you been up to?
Well, I've recovered from my 100-mile bike ride. To be honest, about Thursday, I just suddenly felt really tired. That's catching up with me. And then I went surfing. So I've spent the last 2 days in the Wave, which I think gets quite a few mentions on this show, down in Bristol. And I'm even more exhausted now. My upper body has had it. I get hit in the head by the board. I've got a bruise on my forehead. Oh, man. But it is such fun. It is such a lot of fun.
Well, that sounds cool. And as you asked, I've had a nice week as well. I've done a couple of interesting chats, actually, this week. I was chatting to James Allison, Mercedes technical boss.
Oh, yes.
Do you know, he was fascinating about Lewis Hamilton and his desire to win. He described Lewis as being haunted by the need to win. Haunted. I thought that was such a good description. Can you relate to that?
Well, I think all racing drivers have this desire to win. Michael Schumacher said something interesting when I won the championship. He said, I'm really pleased for him because I think he needs it. And, you know, that's that need to win is different from wanting to win, isn't it? And I think that that's an interesting, we'll be very keen to listen to your interview with him.
Why did Schumacher think you needed it?
Well, it's interesting when your opponent seems to know you better than you know yourself. I think you drive yourself, in order to get the result, you have to be prepared to go way past your own limits. And why would you do that unless you really needed it? But I mean, Lewis has talked about races and there not being a meaning. So his support of the Black Lives Matter movement, I think last year, gave him a sense of meaning. So he knew what he was doing when he was racing. He wasn't just driving a car for himself. He wasn't just winning because it's more prize money or whatever it is for him. He had some other reason for doing it. And I think those things are motivators. And I think Ayrton Senna was clearly doing it for more than just winning races. So it is an interesting concept.
Now, funny you should mention Ayrton Senna, because another guy I've spoken to this week is Joe Ramirez, who used to work for McLaren. And we were talking about, funnily enough, an incident that you were kind of involved with, DH. Suzuka 93, when Senna had come up and lapped Eddie Irvine, and then Irvine unlapped himself because he was scrapping with you on the racetrack.
Yeah.
And then Senna goes and lamps Irvine in the Jordan Hospitality after the race. And so we were just getting Joe's thoughts on that. Oh, and he said Senna, Ayrton was so wound up after the race. He said, and then I think he'd been egged on by Berger as well. I think Berger had been saying, go and have a go at him. Oh yeah, Irvine, it's his first race.
We didn't get a chance to ask Gerhard about the truth about that, did we? But I think Gerhard was a very naughty man. And I think he definitely wound up Ayrton. And so Ayrton was well charged by the time he got down there. But it was, Eddie kind of goaded him as well. Eddie is like that. Eddie can be quite in your face.
Any other news? Any other news this week, DH? What's caught your eye?
Well, I think that in the lay week, we've had it's more to do with races and changes of calendar. And I see we've had a dropout in Turkey. So again, we're going to go for our 2 weeks in Austria. Well, I might not be going, but you will be.
I will be. That works for me. Red Bull Ring, fantastic venue. And I actually get to stay in a ski resort when I'm there. So it's not a hardship spending 2 weeks there.
So that's your little holiday, your little trip away. You've got nice Styrian countryside to amuse yourself with. But what about us folk back here? You know, what point do you think we'll be at that point in the championship? Because this championship is now looks like Lewis is stretching his legs a little bit, isn't he? Moving away slightly. Are Red Bull screwing it up with mistakes? Is Max, you know, tripping over himself to win? You know, these are the questions we don't know the answers to. I think Monaco, it's not always a circuit that suits Mercedes. I'm not sure Monaco is a circuit that suits Mercedes more than the Red Bull. Actually, we got an interview with Jackie, haven't we? So Jackie Stewart on late, and we'll ask him what he thinks about the potential result from Monaco. Will Max Verstappen show a little bit more competitiveness, or the Red Bull be more suited to Monaco? I think it will be.
Well, it's 14 points the gap between the two of them, isn't it? And the tide does, how many sort of surfing references can we get into the whole show? Okay, the tide needs to turn, I think, for Max, because I think if Lewis keeps just totting up the points, before he knows it, he's going to be a win ahead, and then that becomes much more of a strategic game for Hamilton. So he needs to get back on that winning wave and start in Monaco this weekend.
He is actually on the crest of a wave, isn't he, Tom? Have you noticed? I think he's riding along on the crest of a wave at the moment. Because Max, if you go to Barcelona, Max did technically what he did there was he dropped in on Lewis's wave, basically. Wave, Lewis is going for the corner and this guy just dives in there.
Max, actually, that's a great analogy. Max has no surfing etiquette, does he? He just gets in there and barges people out the way.
Yeah, he took priority from Lewis, basically, on the first corner. So will we see the same, you know, I think we're going to see some wipeouts. Definitely going to see some wipeouts. So I think we've run out of surfing references. Oh dear!
But hey, you say that you don't think Monaco is going to be a Mercedes track. Well, I always look at the final sector in Barcelona. You know that twisty chicanes.
Yeah.
You never raced on that layout, did you? But that really slow and Mercedes were blisteringly quick through sector three. So I think that bodes well for them. For Monaco, they were quicker than Red Bull through that final sector.
The clumsy chicane.
Yeah.
I hate that. I hate that thing. But I tell you what, he did look amazing, actually, on the exit of that chicane. Lewis, in qualifying, do you remember his quickest lap? He actually got a wheel over that sausage curb and managed to hold on to it. He didn't look like he was going to lift off. And he got a real tank slapper. And that was his fastest lap.
Damon, tell us about the mentality of the drivers coming into Monaco. Because is it all about qualifying? Is it all about Saturday afternoon? Is that your only focus from the first lap of the weekend?
Yeah, you know what the race strategy is going to be, isn't it? I mean, it's stay out in front and try not to stop. You know, that's it. So you have to get the car on the front row at very least. Otherwise, you're going to be looking at other people's gearboxes for 2 hours or whatever it is. So qualifying. And it's a test of drivers. This is more than anything else. It's a test of technique and being in the zone mentally, 100% concentration.
Do you push as hard at Monaco as you would at somewhere like Silverstone where you've got runoff?
I don't think you can. I've said it's. I feel like you've got a straitjacket on when you go to Monaco. You feel very claustrophobic. And I see drivers sometimes, people like Rubens used to always like rub up against the Armco. And I don't think I ever really did that. I mean, I never managed to sort of get over that feeling that if I let it go too hard, I'm going to lose a wheel. But quite a few of them sort of bounce off the Armco and use it as a kind of a... Like, you know, when you go bowling and you can get them to put the sides up.
Yeah, that's me. That is 100% me.
So it stops it going in the gutter. But basically, that's the Armco. The Armco is there to... You can use it, but my God, you know, you've got to just brush it. You can't hit it too hard.
I remember my first visit to Monaco in the mid-90s. And funnily enough, you were one of the first cars I saw on track. And I was standing at the entry to the swimming pool. And in those days... You could stand on the wall on the sort of left apex, because of course the walls were much closer then. They've been pushed back recently, and just the fierce commitment of you guys going into that swimming pool. You say you're not kissing the walls, but that doesn't mean you're not committed. It was fearsome.
No, you're right. I mean, we've been very lucky. I mean, I've been very lucky in my youth to get the right passes at Monaco, and I've been able to walk around the outside of the track right next to the barrier. You know, Bernie would give me a pass and I was actually able to walk the entire during the race walk right next to the side of the track. And there's a picture in one of the autocourse annuals just going into the tunnel of Alan Prost going around Portier, is it? And in the background, there's me and my two mates walking past the Armco on the seaside. But there's nothing like it. There's nowhere else you can get that close to cars. And you really start to realize how powerful these things are, even in the pit lane. I mean, you're standing in the pit lane and they go past us on a pit lane limiter of about, what was it, 50 miles an hour maximum.
It's slower in Monaco, actually, but yeah.
Is it slower than 50? Okay, so you get the sense of this beast going past you. You know, it sucks up all the dust off the tarmac and it shoots out, so you can see all the aerodynamics working as well. They are really scary monsters when you get that close to them. And when they're at full speed going through the swimming pool section, it is awe-inspiring, absolutely awe-inspiring.
And you get Monaco specialists as well. I mean, Pastor Maldonado always used to go brilliantly at Monaco. Yeah, was sort of only Mr. Average really at other tracks. It's funny that, isn't it?
Yeah, I do think somehow aggressiveness seems to pay off. It's that kind of rally technique. And maybe Robert Kubica, you know, I thought he was absolutely fantastic through one of the best ever qualifying laps I've ever seen. It's one of his Monaco pole laps. It wasn't a pole lap, but it was a qualifying lap through the swimming pool section that absolutely took my breath away. And Nigel Mansell. I saw Nigel on one of his qualifying runs at the top of the hill going into the casino, and he came over the crest at the top, and I thought, he's not going to stop. There's no way he can get that through the corner, and he did. You know, this is back going back to the turbo Honda Williams, and so that was, you know, it was absolutely terrifying to watch.
Who else are we looking forward to seeing in Monaco this week? So we've got Lewis, we've got Max. It's going to be nothing between them. But who else do you think is going to go well?
I don't know. Danny's won a race there. I think he's quite good there. Yeah, Danny Ricciardo. And I think Charles Leclerc is, I think it's an opportunity for him. I think he's the kind of driver, I think, who can pull something magic out at somewhere like Monaco.
And just to go back to my Sector 3 in Barcelona, Ferrari didn't look too bad there as well. So good mechanical grip from that car as well. So Leclerc, yeah. And can you imagine if Leclerc put it on the front row and then he just hold everybody up? Yeah. You can't get past.
You need a nimble car. I mean, you talk about good mechanical grip. I mean, I just talked about them going down the pit lane. You know, once they're going above sort of 60, 70 miles an hour, the aero is working all the way. So if they do need to be able to have a car that can ride undulations, but it needs to be nimble and just well balanced, a car that the drivers can throw around. If it's lazy, if it doesn't move, if you turn and nothing happens, you know, the back doesn't start to take a set, then you can't get around those corners. And you looked at, someone did a graphic, I saw a graphic recently of the length of this year's Mercedes next to a 1988 Honda McLaren, and they're about 4 foot longer. I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, so you're driving a coach almost by comparison to what you used to drive around here. And when Jackie won, he had a short wheelbase Matra, Tyrrell. And I've seen that thing at Goodwood. And it's so short, it's untrue. It's like a go-kart. I mean, no, what, it would have been brilliant around Monaco, but quite nervy. But it was almost square. You know, the wheelbase was almost square. These ones now, they're so long.
When was your first trip to Monaco? Talking of Jackie.
Well, it wasn't. I never went with my dad raced. So
why not?
I missed all that. I don't know why. I think probably I was at school and they you know, it wasn't, didn't fit into the program.
Oh, it wasn't that your mum and dad didn't want you to go to the race because of the potential accident or anything like that. It was just because otherwise engaged.
I think my dad was probably having too much fun as well. He didn't want the kids around. Probably something to do with it. I wouldn't have thought it's a good place to bring your kids. It's a lot of walking and a lot of stairs, as you know, and it's difficult to get around. But it was also, I think it was at school time. So we used to go to Monza, but at the end of the season, end of the summer holidays.
DH, there are some great landmarks in Monaco as well. And I'm reminded of, do you remember 2 or 3 years ago, or maybe it was longer, I can't remember, but you and I had a tour of the cellar of the Hermitage Hotel, right? So the Hermitage is the hotel as you're going up the hill, isn't it? Towards Casino Square on the left. And you and I don't know what we were doing, probably up to no good. But anyway, we ended up in the cellar, didn't we? And how many bottles of wine was it in that cellar? Was it 400,000 bottles of wine?
It was a lot of cellar. I know that. And a lot of shelves. And this guy was very proudly showing us stuff that went back to like the French Revolution. There was like bottles of wine.
It was mad.
I mean, no one's going to open that, are they? I don't know. Bats will fly out or something.
And I remember you making a beeline towards, it was all done in years, isn't it? And you ran to the 1996 section.
Yeah. I won in the wrong year. Apparently 95 was a much better year for wine. I miss that. But I did take a few pictures down there. It was incredible seeing these really old bottles of wine.
Yeah.
And presumably someone goes into the hotel de Paris and goes, I'll have one of the, you know, Louis Latour 1750s, please.
Yes, that'll be 50,000 euros, sir. Yeah, no problem, because it's Monaco. Well, hey, and actually, talking of big money, have you ever been into the casino?
I did. Yeah, I've been into the casino. We did a film shoot in the casino.
No, forget filming. Have you ever been in there because you just want to have a go?
I'm not a gambling man, Tom. It doesn't appeal to me. I don't get it. I walk in there and I just think there's all these people looking really kind of haunted and sort of stressed and they're all sitting staring at a table. No, I haven't. But my dad, really curiously, before my dad even knew about motor racing, he was in the National Service and he went to Monaco on the HMS Swiftsure and he went up to the casino and won a few bob. Walked in, won some money, left, and he never even knew they had a Grand Prix at Monaco. And about 5 years later, he's actually racing in his first Grand Prix in Monaco.
That is a great story.
I think the money was spent already by then.
We've got more insights into Monaco, a historic race on the F1 calendar, coming up. But we just wanted to let you know that if you like incredible stories from F1 history, you'll love our new documentary podcast, F1 on the Edge. Episode 1, Monaco's Lost Diamond, is out now. Here's a little preview.
On the noses of Jaguar's Formula One cars, sparkling diamonds are speeding through the streets of Monaco at 150 miles per hour.
They were beautifully cut, flawless diamonds, worth $300,000 or $400,000 each.
Suddenly, one of the diamond-encrusted Jaguars is skidding out of control towards the metal barrier. The driver is unhurt. But what about the stone? Where has the diamond gone?
Somebody has taken it or somebody's stolen it.
Are you suggesting a team member pocketed a large diamond?
Admittedly. Did it cross my mind to take them off? 100%.
There were plenty of people who never believed it was a real diamond on the car.
It's somewhere. It can't just have disappeared. Somebody knows where this is.
To hear the full, incredible story of Monaco's lost diamond, listen to F1 on the Edge, out now, exclusively on Spotify. Hang on a minute. Look who's in the waiting room. Now, that's a face that I recognise, and you have known that face for a long time.
And I'm sure the listeners will recognise his voice as well.
Shall we let him in?
It's rude to keep him waiting, Tom. Well, we're, of course, completely honoured to have Sir Jackie Stewart, winner of 3 Formula One World Championships, and, dare I say it, one of the all-time great racing drivers, if not great human beings. I've given out quite a fulsome praise to Lewis Hamilton, so I'm going to give one to Jack as well and say he's also one of the greatest human beings ever to have walked the planet. And he never stops working, so we're very, very grateful to have you, Jackie, on the show. And we're really keen to get your insights on the Monaco experience. And there's no one better to talk to, really, than yourself. Maybe my dad, if he'd been here, because he did win it rather a lot. But we'll. You can comment on that.
He would have more tales to tell as well.
He would have. Maybe some he couldn't tell.
Jackie, how are you? It's lovely to see you.
Well, I'm in good form, I think. I'm doing a lot of walking with my dogs and getting fit. I've got a gym downstairs, so I'm probably better than I've been for quite a long time in physical terms. I'm going to go to Monaco for the Grand Prix, and that'll be the first Grand Prix I've been to since Portugal last year.
Where are you right now? You're in Switzerland or in...
I'm at home in Switzerland, yes, indeed. Beautiful sunshine, lovely sky, and quite nice and warm.
Famously, you avoided serious injuries when you were racing. Nowadays, Jackie, the drivers are super fit. I'm sure you don't do it, but we can follow Lewis Hamilton in his bathroom with his top off on Instagram. He likes to post pictures of himself, and he's obviously very fit. But you look back at the drivers of your era, my dad's era, and what did they do for fitness back then? Because I saw a picture of Jim Clark, and I have to say, he didn't look too buff.
Keep in mind, the races were much longer in my day. The fatigue level was much higher than it is today, without doubt. Because when I see the guys getting out the cars today, they're fresh in comparison to what we were going through, and your father and Jimmy and Nigel Mansell as well, and all sorts of people right through the period, not just in my time, but shortly thereafter. I kept myself fit. I had a trainer. I always did a lot of running. I always thought I had to be fit. I mean, a Grand Prix takes a long time in those days. I mean, 100 laps around Monaco, for example, is a lot more than 60 laps. And the 40 to make the 100 is when you're most tired and you're dehydrated because there's no fuel getting into your mouth, no water, no nothing that gave you more energy. So you had to be fit. And your dad won Monaco, what, 5 times, was it? I won 4, actually, because I count my Formula 3 as a great win. It was one of my biggest wins because that got everybody's attention. When you win the Formula 3 race in Monaco, you're almost guaranteed to get a drive in Formula 1 the following year. But that wasn't a long race.
Jackie, look, we're talking Monaco. You've had great success, as you've just said. What does it take to do well through the streets of the Principality?
Not drive too quickly. You can never overdrive in Monaco. It's a very demanding circuit. You can't make mistakes. Your concentration must be absolutely right. You've got to have a decent starting position. It's still the crown jewels of Formula One. It's still the most glamorous, the most colorful, the most exciting. And in my day, keep in mind it was the swinging 60s and 70s. The Beatles were there, the Stones were there. Elizabeth Taylor was there, all sorts of fancy folk because of the Cannes Film Festival and the Princess Grace bringing a lot of people to Monaco that might never have gone to a Grand Prix. You know, it was different. I think the concentration fact must be about the same, but I think the fatigue was much higher. I mean, no power steering, definitely gear shifting. You would do 28 gear shifts per lap for 100 laps, and you would be bleeding with your gloves on, and a BRM certainly. Anyway, whatever you're in, it's tough. And I think Monaco's still that way. You can't make mistakes. You can't kiss the wall.
Do you think that it suits some drivers more than others? Because it's very claustrophobic. I found it, you know, it's a little bit, well, someone described it as trying to ride I think it was PK, said it's like trying to ride a bicycle in your bathroom. You know, there is the sense that you cannot get your elbows out. But some drivers seem to take to it. And some, you know, is there a kind of style of driving you think that suits Monaco?
I've always felt you've got to be very smooth in Monaco. Most people try to bully a car in Monaco. That's quite the wrong thing to do. Nobody likes to be bullied, whether it's man, woman, or machine. And if you make love to the car, if you're gentle with the car, if you coax the car into doing things, you go much faster. And that happens in, of course, a high-speed racetrack also. It was much more evident because you're so close to everything. There's got no runoff space at all. There's nowhere where there's runoff space. And in those days, there was little or no light in the tunnel. Now it's beautiful. I mean, there's like daylight in the tunnel now. So there's a lot of things in Monaco that are different than any other racetrack, even though there's other road courses everywhere and from time to time, but nothing as tight as Monaco.
And what about Graham Hill, Jackie? I mean, Mr. Monaco, 5 wins, you got 3 in Formula One. Talking about drivers suiting the track, what was it about Graham?
Well, he was incredibly focused. He was really a very focused man when he was in a racing car. There are some people who are more relaxed. Jimmy was more relaxed, but Graham was always right in everything he did with regards to the preparation. His preparation was much more focused, I think, than any other racing driver that I know. Because in those days, you were communicating with the mechanics. There were no, no electronic help coming through from the car for everybody in the garage to see what you were doing wrong. In this particular case in Monaco, you had to drive the car to finish first you must finish. And Graham Hill knew how to do that, not just at the Nürburgring or Monte Carlo, where there were demanding circuits because of the number of corners. In the case of Monaco, it was because there was no space anywhere, and there wasn't any space at the Nürburgring either. So both of those racetracks, you could not make an error on. Graham was an incredibly focused man, and he was a serious man. He was a very serious man. He was a great raconteur as well. But when he was driving a racing car, a race weekend, Graham Hill was a pretty focused guy. You didn't get much out of him.
You said, actually, Jackie, in the introduction to, I think, one of his books, you said that he had a frightening intensity, you know, sometimes frightening his intensity. And I think I can understand a little bit what you're saying, having been his son.
He was a frightening man when he was being serious. I mean, he did not suffer fools gladly. And that applied to mechanics or team principals or teammates even. He was a very serious, methodical, focused, I think more than anybody else I've ever met behind the wheel of a racing car. I don't think he had quite the natural ability that a Jimmy had, or maybe other drivers have had. But he made himself fast, and he was absolutely meticulous with his setup. He had the wee black book with everything on it, every adjustment that was made.
I think you're absolutely right. I would totally agree with that. And I would put forward once an idea that my dad had, what he had perhaps in abundance, was a power of concentration. And that also has an effect with, you know, that's affected by your fitness. And I wondered whether him having rode when he was younger, I think maybe he had the ability to stay focused throughout a Grand Prix, a long Grand Prix like Monaco, maybe a little bit better than the others.
Well, I think you've brought up the right subject, because if you're a rower, you're on the limit for a very long time with muscular pain. As a rower, I'm sure. I'm not one, but I watch them. And I think to myself, wow, that's painful. From about the first 5 seconds or 10 seconds out, you're pulling and pushing and against an incredible amount of effort. And in those days, there definitely was more physical participation from the driver than there is today, for sure. I would lose 6 pounds at least driving a Grand Prix, and you'll be soaked. So your father was a very fit man. It was a hidden asset of his determination and the physical condition that he found himself in, because you never saw your father retiring. You never saw him coming in with, you know, absolutely drenched in perspiration and not being able to go onto the podium or ever fall off the podium. And you saw lots of drivers doing that in later years, you know, whether it was Piquet or whether it was Mansell or whether it was quite a few drivers had problems, you know, keeping up with it after the race was finished. So your father was a tough guy physically. He may not have been winning Mr. World, but I don't know. Fortunately, I didn't see him naked very often.
But I mean, you mentioned the podium. I mean, you know, in some ways, this is a very kind of gallant sport, isn't it? Because it showed you that all that pain and suffering, but at the end of it, you get the chance to go up and kiss Grace Kelly, or maybe shake hands.
I've got a whole bunch of pictures up here on the wall. The number of me winning Grand Prix in Helen, being by my side and being kissed while I'm holding the trophy, all of that went on. It was more colourful, it was more glamorous, it was more exciting. The monarch of the day would be there in most of the Grand Prix circuits. And there was a much more physical presence in the podium than there is today. And it was more glamorous in that respect. And again, I go back to say the swinging 60s and all of that. I say, you know, motor racing was dangerous and sex was safe in the swinging 60s.
Jackie, in the swinging 60s, how hard was it not to get distracted at Monaco?
I think, again, it's part of the animal, part of the driver, being able to switch off. I mean, I can remember lots of times when very fancy folk would be coming up to want to talk to you as a Grand Prix driver, whether it was, you know, a famous movie star, or whether it was a terrifically good-looking girl, or whether it was one of the Greek, you know, Onassis or Nearchos coming up. I remember he came up to me and said, oh, I want to sit in your car, Jackie. And he sat in the car, and then he said, I want to hear it while I'm in the cockpit. And Kentel allowed him to do it.
Was that just before the start?
Yeah, this was not before the start of the race, but before the start of practice and qualifying, you know, maybe 15 minutes before the start. And that sort of thing. But then the light goes out. And in Monaco, you've got to be clean and you've got to not hit any curbs and you've got to, you know, lots of people are late, late breakers. You had to brake fairly late, but don't brake too late in Monte Carlo. And by the way, if you go in too fast, you come out too slow. I found out in Monte Carlo that I didn't have to have the latest of braking, but sure as hell, I had to have a clean exit. And that's where the speed was going up that hill. And the same going into the tunnel.
Do you think, Jackie, if you'd been my driver coach, I would have won Monaco?
I don't see any reason why not. I think we could have changed you enough so that you would have won Monaco.
I definitely needed a bit of inspiration sometimes.
Hey, DH, what about the distractions of Monaco for you?
Jackie was talking about all the people on the grid. I mean, we won't be getting it this year, sadly, but you know, it is a famous venue for people to want to appear and come on the grid. And Martin Brundle's grid walk was always littered with like far too many celebrities. But there's a fantastic picture of Jackie and my dad talking to Peter Sellers and Britt Ekland, I think. Is it Britt Ekland? Is that right? Isn't it? Yes. That was his girlfriend, I think, at the time. Fantastic, you know, scenes of these superstars of their era on the grid, literally minutes before they're about to get in the car. But your Jackie didn't have lights. It wasn't lights out. It was a flag. A guy walked out with a flag and dropped it. But it was quite predictable, wasn't it? You could actually tell before he was going to drop it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you mentioned that wonderful man that your father and I were speaking to. I thought he was speaking to Jim and I earlier, Jim Clark and I earlier. And I suddenly said to him, I said, I didn't know you were Scottish. And he said, I'm not Scottish. But because Jimmy and I, he was such a mimic that automatically he sounded like a Scot. And that's the type of thing that went on in these days. No, I think that the grid is still pandemonium in Monaco, and maybe not so much this year because of the virus and everything. There'll be fewer people on the grid. But that was part and parcel of Monte Carlo. That's what it made it what it was. All the drivers, we went to the palace on Saturday night, black tie dinner for maybe only 40, 45 people. And they were very well-chosen people. The David Niven would be there and other stars that came in from the film festival. The Princess Grace, of course, was the magnet. These were, and that was the night before the race, the Saturday night. And nobody thought that was wrong. I mean, it was perfect. And all the best drivers went. And you talk about the start with a flag. It was Louis Chiron that started there, and he won the Monaco Grand Prix in a Maserati way back in the 20s. And he was well past his best, you know, when I was driving. And he was old, and it was a big flag. And I found out fairly early on that, and he would say, no, 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 not now, not now, no, no. And he would be in the middle of the track telling everybody, no, this is not, no, we're not ready yet. And then he would step back, but never got off what I would call the line coming into the first corner. But when he lifted the flag to go, I learned after about the second Formula One race I was at, he was so weak that his knees bent before the flag did. So as soon as his knees went, I went. I never went into the first corner. I never went into the first corner in Monaco when I won it, other than being first, because I left before everybody else, because Louis Chiron couldn't have stopped Brilliant. It.
And Jackie, what happens? Loads of people have asked me this, and obviously I can't give them the answer, but you can do it. What happens at the winner's party at the Palace on Sunday night?
Well, it was not as rowdy as you think, but we would all go down from the Paris to the, what was the name of that pub that we used to go to? And your father was the ultimate hero of that pub.
Tip Top Pub, wasn't it?
We all went there afterwards. Everybody went there afterwards. The spectators were there, hundreds of people. And it was a big, long party, a great night. And people weren't falling over. I mean, it was mostly beer that were drinking, not champagne. Again, it happened there where it didn't happen anywhere else. That's why Monaco is so unique in my memory. And I was lucky enough to see it during these years. When I won my Formula 3 race, the first man who congratulated me was Juan Manuel Fangio. And I couldn't speak. I was so impressed.
Wow, that's wonderful. What about this year then, Jackie? We've got Max Verstappen, Lewis Hamilton going hard at the front. Who do you think is going to do it this weekend?
I think Verstappen might be the driver going around Monaco quickly, but the Mercedes-Benz is still the best car on the track with a huge benefit to the driver. And that's its strength. And whether it's Lewis, who I think is the number one driver in that team without any doubt. Bottas, I think, is very good, but he's nothing in the same class. But the car is so good that he, in fact, can be a competitor and could even win the race. But I think Lewis is driving better than he's ever driven, and he knows Monaco very well now. Lewis has been driving for a very long time. He's a senior citizen, really, in Grand Prix lineups, if you look at the facts of his career. So therefore, I think Verstappen could be a serious threat to him because he drives very aggressively, but he's a top-line racing driver. But the car definitely is no match for the Mercedes.
We've seen in the past a little bit of rivalry with Lewis and his teammate Nico Rosberg. Nico did a good job in Monaco and famously put in a quick time and then lost control of his car, and they brought out the red flag or the yellow flag, so Lewis couldn't improve. And then he actually won that race. And we're not seeing the same competitiveness with Valtteri and friction, if you like, that there was with Rosberg and Lewis. As teammates go, do you think was it something that you experienced ever in your career where you had a teammate who was, let's say, out to get you, you know, to destabilize you?
Well, I had Graham Hill.
Well, come on. I set that one up.
I had Francois Sever. The others were not as good as both of them. And I learned a lot from your dad. I learned a huge amount from your father. For 2 years, I was his number two driver. And then I learned a lot from Jim Clark. Now, Jim Clark never won the Monaco Grand Prix. Maybe one of the greatest drivers that have ever driven. Maybe number two in the world for me of all time.
He's like me, Jackie. He's like me. I'm like Jim Clark. So I've never won the Monaco Grand Prix either.
Oh, dear. That's so disappointing for me. I never knew you'd never won it.
Jackie, who is going to be having dinner with Prince Albert on Sunday night? Who is going to win the Monaco Grand Prix, do you think?
I think Verstappen or Lewis.
No, we need it. One name.
Verstappen.
There we go. Mm. Heard it first.
I bet he's right, Tom.
He normally is, isn't he? All right, Damon, are you ready? Your favourite part of the show?
I'm a bit nervous with Sir Jackie sitting in on this one because I feel like I've got the headmaster here. He's going to tell me if I've got the questions wrong. Right, watch this, Jackie.
Let's do it.
Hi, Damon. It's Richard here from Ipswich. Just wondering if you could design your perfect racetrack, which parts of which tracks would you take to build that track? Many thanks.
Richard, that's a really good question. I think that racetrack design is thankfully it's quite varied, but there are some places that got corners that are a little bit too samey. So I don't think there's any doubt that there are corners that we all have in our back of our mind as being the big challenging corners. You know, it used to be somewhere like Eau Rouge, but Eau Rouge is pretty flat now in Formula One, but it's still very exciting. So you definitely have Eau Rouge in there. You probably have 130R at Suzuka as well. And I'd chuck in some chicanes. I would say maybe a couple of the Monza chicanes or the Hockenheim chicanes I used to love. And what else? The first and second Lesmo I used to love those corners and they got rid of them. Parabolica. And you'd have to have a long, long straight so we can all get a good toe and then a big stop at the end of it. So that's a bit of a mix up of circuits.
It's going to be a long old lap as well, isn't it, Damon?
It's going to take all year to get around there.
Jackie, what are your thoughts? The perfect racetrack?
The Nürburgring, because it was by far the most demanding with every kind of corner at every kind of speed. It was a nightmare. I closed the Nürburgring because it was so dangerous, and I got death threats for clothing it. But it was still the most challenging racetrack that the world will ever see. There'll never be another Nürburgring. But if you went round Woodcock Corner at Silverstone in a Matra or a Tyrrell when Woodcock was Woodcock, 153 miles an hour, you went through there, and there was no runoff area, and you were flat, if you got it right, flat. That was a track. So I couldn't tell you the number of corners I would choose in the Nürburgring because there's too many. 187 or something it is. But if I had only to choose one, I'd probably say Woodcock flat was as important a corner as probably I can remember. You're right, Damon, about Monza and these big fast circuits, the Curva Grande without any wings on. That gave your underwear a little bit of a surprise. So things like that. But at the end of the day, the absolute limit from a driver's point of view, that would have been one of them as well.
Guys, because it's the Monaco Grand Prix week, I think we should doff our caps to Monaco. So from each of you, let's have the best corner at Monaco as well.
When we say the best, I would say you're talking about the difficultiness because it's tricky. The entry to the swimming pool to back are really tricky, but as a kind of iconic thing, coming up the hill and then going into the casino and this Massenet, is it? That's the one. That's the one that you don't want to get that wrong.
Jackie?
The most demanding for me was the swimming pool in the 003, short wheelbase, very tricky, very nervous. To do that quickly was a big success. I've got a great photograph that I have of two guys on the wall looking at me going around right on the limit. And one of them's a poser, and he's there to be seen. And the other one's saying, oh, shit, because I'm right over the top with it. Whereas the corner that Damon mentioned at the top of the hill before going into the casino square, I learned how to do that. And if you do that properly, you go into the corner early and drive round it. You don't go outside and go inside to the apex. There is no apex. It's a big, long corner. And to do that well, it's not really troublesome.
You did that, didn't you, Damon?
Now you tell me.
Well, you never, I mean, if you had money, I would have given you all these answers.
That's it. I'm tighter than you, Jackie. I'm not.
Well, look, we've got one more, Jackie. Let's do our second question for Damon. This one from Mark Hatton.
Hi, Damon. If you could undo one of your mechanical failures that happened over your career, which one would it be?
What a great question, Mark. I was waiting for someone. That is the perfect question for this one coming up to the Monaco Grand Prix. It would be the mechanical failure that put me out of winning a Monaco Grand Prix in 1996. I was leading the race comfortably, and I'm afraid a plug came out of the sump or something in the engine, and the engine seized in the tunnel. That was the end of that.
Jackie?
Mexican Grand Prix in 1968, I would have won the world championship and therefore have taken away that championship from Graham Hill. And the Matra suddenly had fuel tank problems and going through right-handers closed the engine. And I went from winning to not winning. And that took away the world championship for me. For the first world championship I would have had, would have been that one. So that was the one that I think I remember most as disappointment.
That was very generous of you, Jackie. And on behalf of the Hill family, I'd just like to say thank you for that mechanical failure.
Good, because your father always said you were an extravagant boy, and I'm glad I helped that issue. You know,
you're helping a great deal.
Yeah. In the best way.
Jackie, how old was Damon when you first met him?
Well, I think he might have been 7 or 8. He behaved like he was 2. I used to go down and stay at Mill Hill because I would go down from Scotland when I was with BRM for the first year, as Graham was the number one and I was the number two driver. I would stay with the Hills. Damon Hill and his two sisters would come up and waken me in the morning, but jump all over my bed and give me a hard time. I'll never forgive them, actually. It's one of the reasons I don't see them very often. But it was great fun. I mean, to see, for me, today, all these years afterwards, to be talking with Damon and having known him for such a long time, these are the little memories that are very, very special. And Damon and his dad and his mom too played such a big part in my life at that time, because I learned so much from his father, and all these little memories come up very strongly. And that's a real thing. Every single morning they would come up and wake me up and abuse me.
Oh, great memories.
Yeah. He's obviously is Sir Jackie Stewart, but he's sort of more like Uncle Jackie to me anyway.
Damon, did Jackie give you any advice when you started racing?
Don't do it, I think, probably was sort of one of the advices.
Is that true, Jackie?
No, I don't think he ever said, Jackie never said don't do it. But I think that Jackie's opinion was it's best to just let people get on with their careers. And if they are clearly doing something that's wrong, then you get a bit of help and advice from people like Jackie.
Well, because he was Graham Hill's son, I was obviously interested in seeing him do his things, motorcycles, before ever cars. And in fact, I told him not too long ago, and he wasn't aware of it, but I got a call from John Coombs, who was one of the great men of British motorsport at that time, and who his father drove for John Coombs in the lightweight E-type and Ferraris and all sorts of things. And he phoned me up one day that Damon needed a new gearbox. Is there any way you could help Jackie? So I bought the new gearbox for him, and he has no idea about that. I mean, we talked about it the other day, and he had no recall of it at all. So I followed his career because Paul, my son, started racing. And Graham was, no longer there, but Damon was starting his rise at that time. So I saw a lot of, was going on at that time. So
so how much was this gearbox, Jackie? I've got my checkbook out. Look, I can pay you back now.
Gearboxes were very expensive in these days. No, but it was my pleasure, I can assure you.
Thank you, Uncle Jackie.
So, hey, Damon, so when Jackie had his own Formula One team, Stewart Grand Prix, which you started in 1997, didn't you, Jackie? Did you ever think about asking Jackie for a drive? Because you were leaving Williams at the time, end of 96. Was it on the cards?
Quite the reverse. I was trying to get him to drive. Paul and I went all the way over to Ireland.
All the way to Ireland.
There's a great story here, Jackie. Talk us through it. So is this, mid-96, you're trying to get Damon for your new team? Is that what happened?
Well, we thought Graham Hill was a big man, and we thought that his son was doing okay, and we thought it'd be great to have him in Stewart Grand Prix. And we were over there, and he was very nice and very hospitable in Ireland and a lovely house. And he said, well, let me think about it. And then he said, no. We were incredibly disappointed. But he did the right thing. He drove for Jordan, and he won a Grand Prix. And we were a brand new team. But had he been there, he would have stayed at Stewart, and he would have won like Johnny Herbert did win. And we might have even won more races, I don't know. But it was a loss for us, I can assure you. It was a big disappointment because we thought he was going to say yes.
And I still claim to be one of the, possibly only the only person on this planet that has ever said no to Jackie Stewart about anything. So, I honestly, it was a difficult decision. And I was very, actually, genuinely upset that I had to say no. But it was too much of a unknown because they'd not actually raced at all. So lovely as it might have seemed, and I would love to have driven for Jackie and Paul, but I came down the side of the Irish.
God, guys, though, two great racing dynasties. Can you imagine the Hills and the Stewarts racing together? That would have been something else, wouldn't
it? Yeah, it would have been good. But we'll never know now. So that's it. We'll have to live without that. I'm sorry, Jackie. I've said sorry before. I'll say it again publicly. I am sorry.
Well, I'm still disappointed.
Yeah, you know, generally it would have been, you did very well. I mean, you came in, did you in your first season get a podium at Monaco, was it?
Yeah, we did. The first season, we finished second to Schumacher in the rain with Rubens Barrichello driving, a great race he drove. And to win your first Grand Prix in your first season was a big deal. We finished, I think, fifth in the World Championship in our first year because we had a few podiums. And a few good, you know, point finishing, went back to sixth position in those days. So, and it only lasted 3 years, and then Ford Motor Company wanted to buy it back.
Jackie, what was harder work, being a racing driver or a team boss?
Without any thought, immediately being a team boss. I think when that was going on at that time with Bernie and Max, running Formula One. Barry's a great, and he's a good friend, and now I think he's one of the nicest people in the world. But then, as a team owner, a young team owner, it was a nightmare. You know, having been into the sport as deeply as I was, as a driver for as many years as I, you know, was driving, and then to become an owner of a Formula One team with Paul was a huge undertaking, one of the biggest things that I've ever had to do in my life, I think. But it was a nightmare. We didn't want to sell it in the end, but Ford wanted to buy it. And there's nothing that a Scotsman would like other than what happened in that respect. Now, because we did sell it eventually, but fortunately, reasonably well. But it was a big, big challenge. It was hard work. Much more hard work than driving, I can tell you.
Damon, have you ever thought about Hill Grand Prix, take two?
Well, I think I got a bit of an insight, you know, with my dad tried to start a team as well, and that took up a lot of time. And my mum being a bit sort of, you know, a bit upset about him going back into things, and it took up every split second he had, as Jackie's just told you. And I can remember we were on holiday and Alan Prost had come to see me because he wanted me to drive for his team.
Oh, God, did you turn him down as well?
Well... So I'm literally lounging by the pool with my family out in the south of France, and Alan Prost turns up and he goes, ah, I'd forgotten how wonderful it is to be a driver. And so he just basically, he was working his nuts off, poor thing, and he wanted me to drive for him. And I very stupidly said something which I now regret, which was I didn't want to drive for them because they were too French, meaning that I would be the only English person in the team. But it sort of came out as a bit insulting to the French. So apologies, pardonnez-moi, Alain, and tout le monde français. But I could have done with a bit of coaching from Jackie on everything, really. That would have helped my career.
Well, I think it's time to say thank you very much to Sir Jackie Stewart. Jackie, thank you very much for chatting to us today. It's been great.
Well, I've enjoyed it. Good company to be chatting with.
I'm glad you enjoyed it because it's been great talking to you. And Tom and I are very, very delighted you've come on the F1 Nation podcast.
No, my pleasure. I'll unplug.
Wow, Damon. Well, there is Sir Jackie Stewart, live and unplugged.
Yeah, he's off now. He's off doing something else. He'll be on a flight in about a few minutes. He never stops.
So much energy. But hey, what a great chat. Did you notice at one point he said he makes love to the car?
Oh, yes. He's a bit of a lover, isn't he, Jackie? You know, he's very romantic out there. And of course, it was all about that. Light is right is another one of his sayings. So if it feels light, it's right. And I sort of know what he means, but he probably doesn't know how he does it. He's talented. That's why he was quick. I think he was one of those guys who just had it. And he did amazingly well, you know, as an ambassador and also a safety campaigner. So he's been an advocate for all kinds of things in his life, even after he stopped racing. Do you know, once he stopped driving in racing cars, he never drove on the road. He used to have a guy called Jerry drive him around.
Well, it's got to be a bit of a come down sitting in a traffic jam, right? If you've been racing Formula One, do you still drive, or have you got someone who drives you, DH?
No, I have not. I don't let anyone drive me, Tom. Least of all, I don't know. Maybe I'll let you have a go one day. But they were good questions, weren't they, too? So,
Great questions.
It's great to get these questions coming in and firing and getting some answers also from Jackie. So we should maybe call it Ask Jackie. But anyway, it's still called AskDamonHill@gmail.com, and it's an audio message. So if you get more questions and things that occur to you, then just record your message and we'll answer them best we can.
I owe my love of porridge to Jackie Stewart. Did you know that?
No, I didn't. There's so much I don't know about you, Tom. That's possibly one of the things I didn't want to know about you.
I went,
porridge.
You know what?
Scott's porridge oats.
Yeah.
Or the other oats are available.
I have porridge every day because Jackie has porridge every day. And I learned this when I went to the 99 Nürburgring Grand Prix with him. It was an amazing thing. Myself and brilliant photographer called Darren Heath, we tracked Jackie for the whole weekend. We flew out from Luton on his plane to the race. We ate dinner with them. I sat next to Phil Collins at dinner.
Did he have porridge?
No, but Phil didn't.
This is dinner.
Mr. Collins didn't, but Mr. Stewart did.
And what, at dinner?
Not at dinner. Oh, no, sorry.
Not a porridge for
gruel.
Breakfast, lunch and dinner.
Anyway, so, but Jackie said he sat there having his porridge and I thought, oh, I don't really know about porridge. And I started then and I'm still going. The love of porridge. Love it.
Yeah.
We normally have a section called Any Other Business, don't we, at this point in the show?
Any Other Business. So what's occurred to you, Tom? We've been watching, of course, like Hawks, the evolution. We've got a qualifying on Friday night at Silverstone because they're going to have their support race. Yeah,
we have, yeah. That's new this week, isn't it? What time are they going to do qualifying on Friday?
6 p.m. But of course, we have light long into the evening, so it won't be a light problem, I don't think. The only thing is, I'm thinking, so the idea, I suppose, is that people can finish work and leg it up to Silverstone and watch qualifying, or get home from work and watch qualifying.
I've thought for a while that they're going to try. I always think the next thing to happen is a midweek race. You know how all the Champions League football, Tuesday night. Well, why not have a Grand Prix on a Tuesday night?
Maybe in Austria, they could have the race on the Wednesday.
Why not?
And then get home earlier. Or just do it straight back to back. Basically, they have a race on a Sunday and a race on a Monday. Actually, why don't they do that? Why don't they move it forward a bit so that the race qualifying takes place on Thursday or something? And then they can have a race on Saturday and a race on Sunday. They're bang, you've got two Grand Prix in one weekend.
And once you've done all the practice for the first one, you don't need practice for the second race, do you?
No, we don't want practice. Yeah. The more they practice, the more they work out what to do and the less mistakes they make and less interesting it is, you know.
So just bounce from one race to the next. I like this. On Sunday, another race on Monday. So
we should organise F1. We should do it, actually. I think you could make me FIA president.
Oh, DH, great stuff. Well, I'm off to Monaco in about 3 hours, actually. So I better start getting organised for that.
That's early, isn't it?
Well, it all happens a day early, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, it does. Of course, Thursday, yeah.
Yeah. And I can't wait to see the McLarens in their gorgeous golf colour scheme. One of the most iconic liveries at one of the most iconic racetracks.
Well, have a lovely time. What can I say?
I'm sorry you're
South
not going to be
there. France, Portugal. Yeah, I'm going to brave it out back here and we'll be watching on telly.
And if I manage to get into the cellar of the Hermitage again, I'll send you a picture.
Do that. Yeah, have a nice. But have a bottle on me. Go on. But not an expensive one, right? From the bottom of the list. Okay.
That will still be expensive, you know that.
If you're probably about £3,000. Yeah.
Well, it's been great to chat. And it's probably time to end the show.
Okay, we've got to go sometime.
Shall we do it then?
Well, thank you very much for listening to this edition of F1 Nation.
What have I got to say? F1 Nation is produced by F1
in association with Audioboom.
See you next week.